This episode of The H is brought to you in part by Human HQ. Human HQ is designed for folks who care about connecting over meaningful and open discussions about life, who desire to be an active part of a supportive community, and who seek to continuously improve and cultivate their best lives. It's a space for people who don't just talk about life, but do something about it, and want to surround themselves with others who do the same. Check out humanhq.org for more information, or follow them on Facebook and Instagram at HumanHQ. From Milieu Media Group, this is The H, a podcast about the people and places that make Houston, Houston. I'm your host, Luke Brauner, and this is Season 2, Episode 10, Why Not? With Alicia Lawyer. In 1984, when I was 4 years old, living in Shreveport, Louisiana, at some point, after receiving an unexpected bonus at work, my dad asked my older brother and me separately, if we could have one really nice gift, what would we want? I don't have the faintest clue how my brother responded. It was probably something sports-related. I do remember what I asked for, though. I wanted a record player. Even at 4 years old, I'd already discovered a deep love for music, and to my surprise, I got exactly what I asked for. I mean, basically. I got a 3-piece turntable and speaker set made by Fisher Price. It wasn't a toy, though. It was an actual turntable and speakers. I also got my first few records. Lionel Richie's Can't Slow Down, the soundtrack to one of my all-time favorite films, the 1984 West Coast street dancing masterpiece, Breakin', and what remains to this day my favorite album of all time, Michael Jackson's Thriller. I spent countless hours throughout my childhood resetting the needle on those records and being shaped by the experience of really studying the sounds on them. My love for music has been expanding ever since, as has my vinyl collection. It wasn't until recently, however, that I began to appreciate orchestral music. That didn't begin until I met Alicia Lawyer, founder of the River Oaks Chamber Orchestra, or ROCO for short, in the fall of 2017.
I'm Alicia Lawyer, and I founded ROCO. I'm an oboist, and I have played in many different places throughout the world. I grew up in a small town in East Texas. My dad was a band director. My mom was choir director. I had mom second period and dad third period through high school, and I'm an only child. So there you go. It probably tells you a lot about who I am.
Alicia grew up in Van, Texas, about 25 miles outside of Tyler, and like me, developed an affinity for music early on. With both parents being music educators, it came pretty naturally.
Well, music was just a part of the language of our lives. It's a lot like, I think, in Europe, how everybody, amateur or professional, is just a piece of the fabric of their lives. It's like eating. And I think that's something that, in a way, we're missing here, but it's exciting to see how it's bubbling back up. And recently, I think social media has actually made it really exciting to see people develop their own makers and their own creativity in music, which is kind of the last bastion of that.
Some of her earliest memories of performing music were when a touring ensemble called the Young Americans would travel through town.
Young Americans was a group back in the 80s and 70s, I guess, when you could, as after high school, audition for this and tour the country. It was really kind of unique at that point. And they would come through and I would do some small, tiny kids things in it. But I just remember singing Mom the Night Visitors with my mom and dad at their house and mom playing the piano and I took piano and being in my dad's band, trying all the instruments and, you know, banging on the drums. And it was just part of a language that was really great because a lot of times you can't just use words when you communicate. Music really helps you express things that are way deeper and beyond the spoken word.
When did you have that experience for the first time? Where music wasn't just, this is what mom and dad do, but where it was like, okay, I feel something when I do this.
Oh, wow. Journey. When I learned Journey by ear on the piano and just started really enjoying that. And again, a Mom the Night Visitors, I sang the boy role when I was really young. And even though it was in a small place, just knowing how it connected with people. And frankly, competition. I mean, in band and being on the field and marching and just the joy of that sound surrounding you is just incredible. I always tell my musicians now that are professional, seasoned, you know, crusty professionals that it's important to find the time when you got the chills in high school or junior high when you were surrounded by that sound for the first time. And that can be in a rock band, that can be in a choir, that can be in your car, pumping the music loud, singing very, very loudly, or in the shower singing. But there's a time and a place that you really feel the intensity of what music is. I just remember sitting on the bench with my mom with the piano and then my dad playing trombone at Christmas. And just, again, it was so not an abnormal thing. It was just a part of your life, I guess, is how I keep verbalizing it.
Alicia played several instruments as a kid, drums, flute, piano, etc. But in fourth grade, she discovered and began studying the very odd, very difficult to learn oboe.
Usually people start on flute or clarinet or something and move on because it's a specialty instrument. But yeah, I started right away. I don't mind standing out in a crowd, and it sounds horrific the first year or two you're playing it. So there's a reason it's represented as the duck and Peter and the wolf, or that it used to be the war instruments, the sham back in the war days. So,
what was it about oboe?
Just something unique, the sound, the idea that, you know, that it was challenging and you had to practice a lot and you had to really work at it. But growing up with music parents, you know, everybody thought I was destined to be a musician, and I fought it all the way because I wanted to be a physicist. And I read this totally geeky book in seventh grade called Einstein's Brain, and it was a fiction book, but I love sci-fi fiction. And I realized I wanted to solve the unified field theory, which is kind of crazy. But science and math were what I loved, and I had a great, crazy, wacky physics teacher in high school, Mr. Kroschelik, and he created a love and a humor and experimentation with it that was so great. And I just saw the possibilities and the creativity of quantum physics and all the different things that can come of it, that have come of it since that era.
On top of studying oboe, singing in the choir, and being an active member of the physics club, Alicia also joined her high school marching band drumline, playing snares, and eventually even became the drum major.
It's funny, though, because I wound up going to an all-state music camp at UT in the summer from sophomore, junior year, and I actually met my husband there. We met at band camp, which is super dorky, but we did, and he was a drum major, too. So I think there's a whole book to be written about drum majors marrying each other, but we just went to a dance. We were both an all-state orchestra band, I guess. And then UT had this really great program where they invited all-state musicians to come to camp. So it was a great music group. And he and I both were there, and we met. And he asked me to dance the first year, and the next year I did dance with him. But then we didn't date. We were dating other people. And we had a mutual friend from the camp. And I called this guy and said, "Oh, my gosh, Michael, I'm not coming to UT with the crew. I'm actually going to SMU." And he goes, "Well, guess who else is going to SMU? Larry."
So at the very last minute, Alicia decided to heed the advice of an oboe teacher she'd been taking lessons from in Dallas and abandon her plan to study nuclear physics at the University of Texas in Austin and move instead to Southern Methodist University in Dallas.
So I did a double major at SMU in oboe and physics. And I realized halfway through the first year of the labs in physics that I was spending more time writing about the 5% deviation at the end, the stories about why that would happen, than the actual lab. And I was like, maybe this is not the correct place for me. So yeah, there's like an earthquake in Malaysia, and that's why the ball rolled that way. And it was, you know, it was just completely goofy stuff. So I realized that creativity was really what I was interested in, and then switched straight to oboe.
Was that a hard choice to give up physics?
No, not at that point, because I really felt like it wasn't the path. I mean, it would have taken a long time to get to the place I wanted to be in that. And there were just so much more options for oboe, and so I was kind of wrenched into oboe many different times, and now I know why.
It was during her sophomore year that Alicia began dating Larry, the boy from band camp, who was at SMU studying business, finance, and computer science. They dated throughout college and got engaged their senior year.
In March, we were engaged, and we were up in New York. He was applying to Wall Street, and he worked for a bank up there, ultimately. And I was auditioning at another school in Manhattan, and I was very green, as they say, and what that means to people who are not my age, that means that you were very inexperienced and young and didn't have a clue what's going on. On a Sunday, we were touring New York, and I'm like, "Oh, look, there's Lincoln Center. That's cool." And then I'm like, "Oh, look, there's Juilliard. That's a good school." And so I'm like, "I think I want to go look inside." And Larry's like, "Okay." And this time, it used to be an access to Juilliard off the back alley. I mean, it was really very unobtrusive entrance. Now, if you go, the entrance is from Lincoln Center. It's this massive staircase up to heaven. It's like crazy. I would probably have never walked in at that one. But this one was off this back alley. And I walked in, and there was a guard there, and there was a chair, and it said, "Do not come in. We're not open." So I went in, and I said, "I want to audition for your school." And she goes, "Oh my gosh, that's so funny. I just got a cancellation for Tuesday afternoon at 4:40. I just remember coming out to my fiance and going, "I need $80 for an application fee." And he's like, "What?" And back then, there really weren't ATMs. So we're like going to banks. Anyway, she called me the week later and broke protocol and said, I just have to call you. You're like a homeless person that walks off the street and you just got into Juilliard. So it was just really, it's pretty interesting.
So within 2 weeks of graduating from SMU, Alicia and Larry got married and relocated to New York City, where he worked on Wall Street and she worked on her master's at Juilliard.
I go with whatever is planted in my brain. I'm obedient to what's planted in my brain.
You saw Juilliard and you decided to take it.
I did, but I don't remember kind of having those thoughts. I just kind of did it. I was not in any way thinking I was going to do that. And it was just really fascinating. It was the perfect thing for me. It was incredibly competitive, but at the same time, I found some lifelong friends that, frankly, are in ROCO now. And when I started ROCO, they're the people I thought of that I wanted to be in the orchestra. And just people who can get past themselves on stage and take great joy in their performance, but also be very vulnerable on stage, which is really rare to see in any type of performance. Our trio is kind of back together again, and our woodwind trio, flute, oboe, bassoon, and we did so many gigs while we were at Juilliard. We did a mafia wedding that I don't want to know about. You know, we played, there's so many stories. Our very first gig we ever did together, we played out in Long Island. We had a wedding to play, reception, and it was a trio, right? It's like this small group that doesn't make much sound, and I had them sign the contract, and so we went out there, got there early, thank goodness, because there wasn't the name of the country club that they put on the contract, so we had to go all over Long Island looking for the right place. When we got there, it was 500 people in a tent outside in 56 degrees, and I'm sorry, but you probably couldn't hear us even next to us, right? I guess we were eye candy. I have no idea. But it was so cold, they had heaters, so every time the heater was on, we were like crouched in our chairs because it burned our heads, and then when it was cold, we were freezing. When it was time to leave, we had this guy come up and say, come with me, in this voice, and this intoned voice. And back then, I think about the Sopranos show, and he took me to this place, and he sat behind a desk that was all scrolled and all this stuff. And I think he was the manager, but he seriously looked like he was part of the mafia. And he was really nice. He said, hey, we'll get the limo to take you back to the train station. We're like, oh, that's so nice. So we finish the gig, we get in the limo, we start driving. The guys get lost. There are two guys in the front seat that look like bodyguards. They seriously look like bodyguards. They get lost. So they pull into a very not nice looking gas station, and the flutist and I have to run to the restroom. And of course, we leave Kristen, our bassoonist, in the limo with these two guys. We go into the only one that's open or we can get into is the male bathroom, which is really disgusting. And when we close the door, we realize there's no handle on the other side. So we get trapped in the bathroom, and then our friend Kathy, who's the flutist, starts freaking out. She is claustrophobic, and it became like a Lucille Ball thing where she climbed on my shoulders and tried to get out the transom. Didn't work. So we took all our shoes off and we're banging. We got the door broken and open, and by the time we came out, you know, Kristen had thought we'd abandoned her. And so we go into town and have a margarita, and I promptly lose the check for the gig. So that was our very first trio gig that we ever played.
After 2 years and a lot more gigs, when Alicia had finished her master's at Juilliard, she and Larry decided to make the move back to Texas.
We actually decided to come back to Houston, where he's from, because we really just wanted to have a marriage and have time together and be together. And most people don't know that orchestral positions are lifetime tenured jobs. You have to wait for someone to retire or pass away. And across the nation, there may be two openings all across the nation per year in any instrument. So, I mean, you really can't say, I want to go live here and have a job. Sometimes it works out, but very rarely. But I did a lot of, when we first moved here, I did a lot of gigging. I did the DJ position at the radio for classical radio, K-Arts. And then my husband got into INSEAD, which is a school in France. So he got his MBA over in France. So we moved to France for a year and a half, which was not only life-changing, but music-changing for me, because instead of just being focused on auditioning for orchestras, I was really focused on what music was to people. And I started doing a lot of salon concerts in people's homes. And again, it was just a part of people's lives, amateur, professional, side by side. Clear delineation, but clear respect on both sides, too. It was just a fascinating, and it colors a lot of what ROCO is. It just does. Of just the idea that it can be woven through your community. It can be a community orchestra and be professional, if that makes any sense. That it can be fully professional musicians, that their full-time job is in music, but it's fully community embraced. And I think that's really what we're going for with ROCO. And I think we've successfully done it, but it comes from being in France and seeing the pervasiveness of music.
Salon shows, as Alicia explained to me, are the orchestral equivalent to the modern house shows many singer-songwriters play today. Essentially, it's when anywhere from 1 to 4 musicians would provide entertainment for dinner parties in people's homes, and it's apparently a fairly common thing.
It's almost like playing Scrabble after dinner, or a charades after dinner. It's you play music after dinner, you know, or the evening is about the concert. I mean, there's a lot of choices. It's just that, again, it's part of the entertainment. It's not a special, ooh, here we go, you know, it's just what you do.
After a year and a half in France, once her husband had finished his MBA, they moved once again to Houston.
So once I got back here, I found a job at University of Houston as professor there, and I was a part of three startups because I was really ready to do something different. I was kind of not auditioning anymore, to be frank, because I really wanted to see it done in different ways. And so I was part of three startups kind of consecutively in a row as principal oboe, part of the administration. I wasn't the founder of these three, but I saw it done three different ways. They each had brilliant ideas. They each had their own ideas. They kind of, each one had about an 8 to 10 year lifespan and kind of overlapped a little bit. And then I gave birth, which was a big step. And so, yeah, that kind of changed things too. Just, you know, you really start to distill and prioritize the things that are important to you. And because I'd been a part of those three groups, I sort of knew what to do. But at the same time, after I'd had my kids, I'm like, okay, I love Houston. It's a great city for so many things. My parents had moved here. And I was like, you know what? I don't want to move from Houston. So if there's no openings because they weren't leaving the jobs, maybe I just shouldn't be an oboist. I was kind of ready to give it up. I was ready to give up the oboe. And I think you get to a submission point, and that's when things maybe start happening.
It was around that time, in 2004, that she found out her church, St. John the Divine, was planning to renovate their sanctuary.
And when I saw the drawings, I knew an orchestra was supposed to fit there. I've been a part of Houston non-musically for many years before Rocco started. Not just in the three startup orchestras, but through Junior League at the Holocaust Museum. Probably the most impactful thing I've done in Houston has been a docent there. All the different ways, the DJs, the DAR, volunteering in various areas, the Beacon, just all these places in Houston. Again, the patchwork idea. But just non-musically, I was a human in Houston. And now when I go and I talk around the nation about entrepreneurialism in the arts, you have to be a human first. And I say that to say that when I found out that the church was renovating, it was my church. It's a place I'd been there forever. And I heard about this, and the problem with classical music, really the only problem, is venue. It's hard to find a venue because so many venues are black boxes, which are used for spoken voice, and it's not usually resonant enough, and it's hard to play in. Or it's so resonant that it's great for choral, but not for orchestra. So it's difficult to find an orchestra that sized place, you know? Jones Hall's too big. There's just not a lot of venues that you can find. So that was really the crux of the problem the other groups had, is where is my identity centered? And I knew that centering around a church, you know, it's different here because in Europe, it's not. It's very normal in Europe to play a concert in a church. Like, that's kind of the venues, right? Here, it's not. And so it was interesting because we're not associated with the church. We are in residence there for the big concerts, but we're not associated with them. But the fact that they were willing for me to come and say, I have this idea for three concerts next year. We're going to do this, this, and this. And they gave us the space. They said, go for it. Why not? You know, and then just do a 501c3 and get the musicians on board. And it was just exciting because it was supposed to happen. And I think I was just equipped. I'd been equipped with all the different times I've been a part of the other groups, seeing the problems, seeing the great joys that had happened. So I started to build an orchestra, and it started to become a why not thing of, why not use the people that I remembered that smile when they play and who really take joy and like I said, vulnerable on stage? Why not have concerts at 5 on Saturday instead of the 7:30? Why not have childcare and music education during and after so all generations can come? Why not play in dozens of venues and, you know, just really bring it into the community? Why not collaborate every single concert? Why not have new music? I mean, it just became a seriously why not orchestra and then a huge experiment. And now 13 years later, it's not my experiment anymore. I mean, it's still got the innovation woven into every fiber of it, but it's other people. And to me, that's the biggest thing is you could say no, you pull people around you that tell you no, but have their own ideas. And it's just cool to release people into their own creativity. I mean, that's what's exciting to me.
So what was the process like? You suddenly have gone from being a professional oboist to owning a business.
I know.
A nonprofit.
My husband, I mean, he has a lot of huge business acumen and he, you know, he helped me with a business plan. And just thinking about that. But again, I'd been a part of the other ones too, so I knew about nonprofit. And back then they didn't have, I mean, it was 13 years ago. So, I mean, back then they didn't have the Fractured Atlas, the Fresh Arts, the groups that can help you do that kind of stuff. So I just kind of went for it. You just have to have that before people will take you seriously. I know a lot of people want to start it for free or start it for this and see if it works. But until you're a real business, people don't support it. So we started right away as that.
The first order of business, however, was to name the orchestra.
So to name it, you had to have something that was mellifluous or very, very good sounding name. And we were on the corner of River Oaks Boulevard and Westheimer. And to me, that's an awesome dichotomy of Houston, because you've got Westheimer that bifurcates like the whole city, and then super short street that goes from Lamar High School to River Oaks Country Club, and it's kind of this odd positioning of bifurcation. And that's not the right word I'm really looking for, but just this really interesting juxtaposition. And so Rocco, my son claims he came up with it. So he was like five, and he said he came up with it. So I'll just go with that. But he thought it sounded cool. So we do have people say Rocco, and I don't care. Just come listen. Come participate.
So Rocco kicked off their first season with a debut performance in 2005 in St. John the Divine's newly renovated sanctuary. But from day one, they've been anything but a typical chamber orchestra.
Rocco started with 40 players because that's what a chamber orchestra identity is. And we still do that four times a year at St. John's because of the acoustics in the space. We're broadcast nationally. We're live streamed from there. It's kind of the flagship part of it. But now, all of the other ways we go, where the Offrenda Day of the Dead in Lawndale that we play, we did a musical trick-or-treat concert at Heritage where a musician was in each house and you as the audience traveled house to house to trick-or-treat for music. All these different ways where we collaborate, Beer and Brass at St. Arnold's Brewery, Peter and the Wolf at the zoo, and they're honoring their wolf conservation they used to do. And so on and on, finding these unique places in Houston to weave music into, to show the uniqueness of Houston, is just so exciting. Like 89% of our season is chamber music, which means 1 to 5 musicians in each concert. One concert, you know, we pair music and wine all the time with it. We have a symphonic chocolates piece that we've played that you eat a piece of chocolate for every movement in the audience while they play. You know, it's just all these ways of intermingling senses, locations, other groups, a true quilting of the arts in Houston. I want to be able to sit down individually with every human in Houston, and I will get there eventually because that's just who I am, and I will trap people in elevators, and I will tell them what Rocco is, and please come, and you know now one of the musicians, and so you can know the rest of them, and it's a personal relationship. It's not about the dead composers. It's something unique, and every person that does a concert they get to do, they get to have ownership of it, and you see and hear who they are individually. To me, that's exactly what Houston is, and that's what's so beautiful about the city, is this pockets that we have of diversity. I mean, we're the most diverse city, and yet we rise up in Harvey, we rose up in Katrina, we rise up with the Astros, we rise up in unity. And it's just kind of amazing to me to see this. We even commissioned a composer to write a piece called Anthem of Hope, Houston Strong, based on our response to Harvey. And it's a piece that we now have open sourced, which means on our website, you can apply to get all the music for free and you can perform it in your ensemble for free or use our recording to choreograph to. And so we have about right now 20 groups in Houston this year that are going to perform it. We did one premiere that I hope gets a big prize because it's called Rocomoji and it's based on emojis. And he wrote it kind of serious, but I mean, it's got humor in it too. One of them's about money and it's really funny, but it's just kind of music of our time. And that piece in particular is probably most people's favorite piece. And then one piece was based on the Jabberwocky that we had commissioned, my favorite poem. One was based on the Sleestak and the cyborgs because of my dad's birthday, because he's a huge sci-fi dude. And just they're all personal. That's what I think people need to know about Rocco. Everything is personal. It's not random. All of our principals travel around soloing, so they are our soloists. So we don't have outside soloists, except singers sometimes. But so we kind of sprinkle around who gets to perform solo next. And our trombonist did it once. And I said, I always offer them money for a commission if they want to commission a composer, because that's what we do. We do it all the time. And he is Swedish. And so he wanted to commission the woman who arranges music for the Salvation Army Band. And he wanted her to write on Dag Hammarskjöld, which was the ambassador, I think, to Sweden in the 50s that got killed in a plane crash. So she based the whole piece on D-A-G and made the whole piece based on that motive. Anyway, it was just like this great story that he did this fantastic, fun trombone concerto. You can get it. Go listen to it. And that's what's fun to me is that if it was just me, it would die on the vine. It cannot just be me. It has to be other people being, again, released into their own creativity and given that permission and given the resources to be able to do it.
In 2017, they even commissioned a piece to honor a longtime icon of the Houston music scene.
We have one commission that's based on Christian Kidd. He was the lead singer of The Hates. It's a punk rock group here from the 70s, and it's still going on. Anyway, he got throat cancer this past year, and the whole community has just surrounded him, and I think he's a dear, dear person. And so I commissioned Dan Visconti to write this piece for him based on his life. So it's not a punk rock piece, but it will have some elements to it for sure. But it's a huge icon in the community. And, you know, we called it Legendary Love. And it's exciting to me to honor somebody in our community that's so interesting.
If I'm honest, the idea that a chamber orchestra would commission a piece of music to honor a punk rocker caught me completely off guard. It's just not at all the sort of thing I imagine they'd be about.
Classical isn't its own world. It isn't. And what's fascinating to me is if you go listen at roka.org to our past concerts, you'll hear the most ridiculous variety of music being written today. Like, we've done 60-something world premieres by this year, and all of them are drastically different. They're not Mozart. Some of them sound a little bit like it, but most of them don't. Everybody has their own language, you know? It's even got more variety in it than every other genre put together. So that's what I want people to discover who are curious about life. I mean, if you want to know about the latest, greatest shoemaker because they're really cool and they do this and this, you're probably going to want to know about our latest, greatest composer that has been to Indonesia and lived there for 12 years or, you know, those kind of stories. And so I just find that there is this massive opportunity to personally connect to humans through this maker movement in music, music maker movement.
Another way Roka is trying to connect to people is to identify and remove any potential barriers between them and this music.
There's a lot of barriers to classical music, and so trying to discuss who we are and yet at the same time be clear about who we are is really hard because they're all barriers. Most people think chamber orchestras are boring or they don't even know what it is, or, you know, River Oaks or a church. I mean, there's a lot of things that sometimes could be a barrier. But it's not about that. It's a space that is a place that we can have musical conversation. And there's so many other spaces that we play in now. We've been able to record and broadcast. I'm one of the few American orchestras doing that because we pay for the rights to do it. And they can be announced nationally is a pretty awesome thing. But the fact, like I said, that only four of our concerts are there, it's hard to get that message out that we have, you know, 89% of our season outside of River Oaks. It's not even close to the River Oaks. So it's been an interesting kind of how are we changing our discussion of who we are. So what we have turned into, instead of a chamber orchestra, even though there's 40 players there, is we are now a music ensemble that flexes from 1 to 40 players in dozens of venues around Houston. Not background music. I mean, nobody puts baby in the corner. But, you know, we want the conversation. It would be like me having a conversation by myself in the corner, which, you know, I've done that before. But, you know, just that music is a connection and a language, and it's not something to be put in a corner in certain situations. I think the hardest part is it's kind of, we've been told it's like an onion. I mean, the more you dig in, the more layers you find. So it's very hard to kind of verbalize that what we do is very strategic, but it sounds like a lot of different things. And it's true. Our strategic thing is shaping the future of classical music, and that can happen in many different ways. But I think every foundation and every grant place is different. There are people as well, and they all look for different things. Some need you to have an education thing. Some need you to have all these different things. And, you know, we don't do pure music education. I mean, that should be in the schools. And if it's not, that's why we're having trouble in music. I mean, that's the main problem. But so a small arts group or mid-sized arts group, as we are, cannot, you know, take that on. But we do the Roka Rooters thing during and after the concerts for people that come to the concerts. We do Peter and the Wolf. But most of what I do and what the orchestra does is relight the pilot light in adults. And we also focus on the elderly and infirm, where we send DVDs to nursing homes and hospitals. We do performances in nursing homes. But just that we, especially live stream, you know, people can access it when they're not able to come and physically be there. So access is one of our biggest things. And our ticket prices are cheap or free, you know, $35, $45 max, and free a lot.
One of the most valuable and unique things Roka offers is something they call Roka Rooters.
Roka Rooters is our music education child care program for kids 10 and under during our main concerts at St. John's. And the kids 10 and under, all the way down to 2 months, get music education and child care. I mean, obviously 2 months is just childcare, but starting around 3, they get a lesson, and then 5 to 10 years old come into the concert for one piece they've heard about live, and then they stay till 10:30 for pizza and movies, so parents get a date night after the concert. And I jokingly always say we're saving marriages one concert at a time.
Their season runs from September to May every year, with unique concerts happening all the time throughout the city.
It starts in September, and then we kind of anchor it with the 4 big concerts. And then the rest of the time, we do the chamber concerts throughout the city. And then we have a series at MATCH, the new Midtown Arts Theater Center. We have, and then a lot of performances, a lot of different places. So
And are you the one that's like hustling that?
Not hustling it so much as coming up with the ideas for it and then asking musicians to have their own ideas as far as repertoire and what we actually play. But we have a full-time staff here, plus a lots of contracted people for librarian and marketing and different things and PR. And so there's a ton of people. I mean, it's a big organization now, 13 years in.
As with any big organization, there are lots of moving pieces and people constantly working behind the scenes. And that's before you even factor in the 40 musicians who make up the orchestra.
Our musicians are from all over the world. They're from mostly now all over the U.S. because a lot of them have moved here. Cellist originally from New Zealand. But they're just all over the world. So half the musicians don't live here. And they fly in to play the big concerts. And then conductors from all over as well. And those are from all over the world. And they're all guest conductors because it's got to be about the orchestra, not about the podium. And I think that's really kind of an interesting dynamic that they're from all over. And the fact that we live stream... We have people watching from Finland on our live streams. It's weird, you know, in the middle of the night. But that to me is what's exciting. It's just this whole, almost like the old Coke commercial. I'd like to give the world a Coke. Just this whole hands gathered around the world kind of thing. It's really fascinating.
Even the creative parts of their work are collaborative, with musicians, conductors, and composers working hand in hand to make the music as good as it can possibly be.
It's really more like we're co-interpreters, like an actor does. Co-interprets the piece together, so we're not just performing. I mean, I always say we're not necromancers. We don't raise the dead like Beethoven. But what's really exciting is when the composer's live and living and breathing with you to have the conversation and say, dude, that doesn't really work on my instrument. You know, why don't we do this instead? It's just an active participation in a compositional process, if that makes sense, instead of it just, no, I don't compose, but I co-interpret and co-create when we perform. And when you see the fact that it's not about concerts, that's not what we do. It's just about connecting the music through the community through music, and it's very different. And then just to really know to stick to your mission. I mean, every group can benefit from that, to be able to say no all the time. We say no every day, all the time, to things that are not on mission. And just to keep it prioritized and distilled, that's part of it. It's not so much about doing more, it's about reaching more people. We are more about what do we already do that can not only draw more people in, but really just have more impact and effect. A lot of what I do is go around speaking about entrepreneurialism in the arts, around colleges and communities. I speak to different groups about that and really not just advise them, but say, here's the future. It's not just about starting your own group. It's about collaboration. It's about cross-pollination. It's about every possible way. Without appropriating, but with the way of just connecting in the arts and just not having our little silos. I think that's the biggest piece. I think we've realized that in so many other areas of the world, and arts is just rife with it in the visual arts, but not necessarily so much sometimes in the performing arts. And so that's definitely part of what we want to do. But more importantly, just bringing more musicians into all the 40 stay the same, but just that each one feels a little bit more ownership of what piece they want to do with Rocco. Like, what are their ideas? What can we help do resources for within the mission? And how does that work? So that's kind of where we're going with this. I don't want anyone to ever say, I have a dumb question. It's a pathway in. And that's what's exciting to me, is there's never a dumb question in Rocco at all. And that's what I love. It's invitational and relational, not transactional. And that's what we want people to really feel.
So for nearly a decade and a half now, Alicia and those who partner with her in the work of running the orchestra have invested countless hours into coming up with creative themes for each season and show, collaborating with musicians and composers from around the world, coordinating the logistics of booking concerts and flights and recording projects and creating merchandise and maintaining their website and fundraising, all the many things that come with running a nonprofit. And for what reason? Simply to offer something beautiful and unique to the people of this city.
I love relighting the pilot light, not only in the audience, but in the musicians, and inviting them into a space of experimentation, vulnerability, and creativity, and taking risks, but again, having a conversation through music. I always felt weird when people would say, I love music. And I was like, that's weird. I don't like to say that, because music is not an entity. I now can define why I don't say that. Music is not an entity. It's not something sitting between us. It's a nonverbal language that goes between people. And when you say, I love music, which a lot of people do, especially when they're young, it just creates this kind of thing, and it's not a thing. Yes, some people say, I love French, but they don't. They say, I love France. I love the people there. I love the experiences, and I love to speak French. They don't really necessarily say, I love French. So I would just say, I love to have people inspired by giving them the opportunities and the resources to come up with their own innovations. And that to me is where I've really come to in what we do now. And I realized that early on, but I could never verbalize it. And I kind of eschewed the fact that I was an oboist. I felt like I had all these different lives. I'm an oboist here, this kind of person here. But now it's just a part of who I am.
I think the thing that I find most inspiring about the work that Alicia is doing through Roco, and in fact the common thread I see throughout her story, is that she's unintimidated by the amount of work required to bring her vision into fruition. Whether it's choosing, as a fourth grader, to learn an instrument that requires far more time, energy, and dedication than most others, or deciding as a seventh grader to try and solve Einstein's unified field theory, or as a senior in college to audition on little more than a whim for one of the most prestigious music schools in the world. When she has a vision for something, she doesn't allow hard work to deter her. She doesn't allow herself to be bound by the limitations others may see. She just goes for it. And in doing so, she's making this city a better place to live. I'd encourage you to learn more about Alicia and Roco by visiting roco.org. Huge thanks to Alicia for being a part of this episode and for the beautiful work she's doing for the good of this city. Thanks also, as always, to you for listening, subscribing, and sharing this show. If you would, please take a minute to rate and review The H on Apple Podcasts. Thanks again, friends. We'll be back in 2 weeks with the next to the last episode of this season. This episode of The H was produced, edited, and mixed by me, Luke Brauner. Our artwork is by the fine folks at Field of Study, formerly known as Spindletop Design. Check out their new site at fieldofstudy.design. Our theme music is by Robbie C., and other songs featured in this episode are by Houston-born and raised piano prodigy, Cameron Pissera. This and every episode of The H is brought to you in part by Pink Cilantro, a social-first digital agency focused on marketing, branding, and all sorts of other great stuff. You can visit them at pinkcilantro.com. Now here's a scene from our next episode.
I also grew up in like a rough community where there's a lot of poverty, a lot of violence, a lot of gangs, a lot of things like that. So I was kind of privileged in my community. But then I realized over time and like overall, I was like, we were like poor like everybody else. But like my mom could afford like the cool stuff that makes it look different, you know?